Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens to the phones we upgrade, the appliances we replace, the cars we wreck, and the paper bottles and cans we drop in those big blue curbside containers? Long after American consumers throw things out, the raw materials they are made of retain significant value and may travel across the city or halfway around the world to be picked clean, melted down, and turned into items we think of as brand new. My guest today is in a unique position to understand how it all works. He was born into a long line of scrappers, and although he chose to be a journalist over a career in the family business, he has spent years crossing the globe in order to investigate the remarkable industry of recyclers around the world, as well as the health and environmental risks that go hand in hand with the financial rewards. Adam Minter is Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview and a contributor to The Atlantic and Foreign Policy magazines. His new book is called Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. Adam, welcome to Think.
I'm so happy to be here.
We tend to think of recycling as this sort of clean and virtuous way to justify our levels of consumption in the U.S. This book I found to be a reminder that the actual story is not only messier, but a lot more complicated than that.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the messages of the book is that recycling is green in the way that dollars are green. It's not necessarily green in the way that we in the U.S. or even in the EU think of it. And the way I tend to tell people about this is no matter how good your intentions, those good intentions aren't going to turn an old beer can into a new one. There has to be a profit incentive for somebody to do it. There has to be economic incentive for somebody to do it. And so most everything that we have that's recycled, that's put into the blue bin or wherever else you put it for recycling, the only reason that it gets picked up and taken somewhere else is that there's an economic incentive to do so, that somebody has a business, that somebody has a livelihood that's dependent on being part of the chain that transforms old goods into new ones. And that's a very complicated story.
I had no idea before reading this book what a perfect example recycling is of the globalization of the economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable. We've all become quite accustomed to the idea that we've globalized, say, our computer manufacturer, that Texas Instruments is now a company that, say, sources components from all over the world. But in the way that our recycling is disposed of and created into new objects is just as diversified. And it's driven by some of the same forces. A lot of people don't like the idea that, you know, the number one export destination for our recycling is China. But it's not because it's cheap labor. It's not because the environmental conditions are bad. It's because China consumes more raw materials, more paper, plastic, metals, whatever it is, than any other place on Earth. And so they're going to need that stuff. So rather than thinking of this stuff as sort of a green good deed, you really have to think of your recycling as a raw material. Your aluminum cans compete with bauxite, which is mined out of holes in the ground that makes aluminum. And China imports bauxite, and it imports aluminum cans, you know, for quite the same reason. And that's the story of globalization that we've all become accustomed to over the last 30 years or so, but most of us, including me really, until I moved to China 11 years ago, had never really thought of our recycling in those terms.
You do clear up here a misconception that some people have when we talk about our greatest export to China is our trash. We're not just sending stuff over for them to put in Chinese landfills. These are reusable materials by and large.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't export trash anywhere. There's no reason to. There's no economic incentive to. In the United States, we have some of the cheapest landfilling rates on Earth. And so if we need to get rid of our trash, the cheapest way to do it is really just send it to the landfill. And actually, Texas has some of the cheapest landfill rates in the United States. The only reason anybody would send something overseas, and better yet, the only reason somebody would import trash from the United States is because there's value in that trash. So, that trash is not trash. As we've all said, one man's trash is another man's treasure. They're importing it for the commodity value in it, and they wouldn't do it unless there was something in there that could be made into something new that could be sold.
And it's done, fittingly enough, often in the same empty containers that have taken new consumer goods from China and dropped them off in the U.S.
Absolutely. And this is one of the most interesting and compelling stories about recycling that I found over my 11 years in China. One of the reasons why recycling goes to China is because it's so cheap to ship. So the example I give is, if right now Shenzhen, which is in South China, that's the workshop to the world. That's the most intensive manufacturing zone in the world. They make a lot of stuff that they export to the United States. And there's competition to send shipping containers of stuff to the U.S. So at the moment, it costs about $2,400 to send a container of whatever, a shipping container, 40,000 pounds of stuff to the United States in a container, $2,400. When those containers arrive in Los Angeles, there's not much to send back because, as we all know, the U.S. runs a trade deficit with China, and that trade deficit means that there's not much to put in containers to send back to China. Well, the shipping companies want to get those containers back to China so they can send more stuff back to the U.S., and they discount them heavily. So the return trip is about $300, about one-eighth the cost of sending something from China to the U.S. Well, if it's only $300 to send 40,000 pounds of anything to China, that's a great incentive for recyclers who have a high-volume, heavy-volume, heavy-weight export to go to China to send it over. And that's one of the big reasons why you see so much U.S. recycling going to China. You know, I often get people asking me, how can this be environmentally sustainable to be exporting all of this stuff to China? Well, those containers are going back to China one way or another. They're going to go back empty if you don't have something in them. So in a way, you can think of it as almost a carbon-free trip to China for 40,000 pounds of your newspaper or your old shredded automobiles, because the containers are going back anyway.
And less newspaper now than ever in the past.
That's very true. It's one of the more interesting things about covering the global recycling trade is you actually get an idea of what's not being used as much. And we've seen over the last 10 years a significant decline in newspapers in the U.S. waste stream. And, of course, we know the reason why, and that is that there's just increasing competition from electronic media. At the same time, what's very interesting is both China and India, which are major scrap newspaper importers, are actually growing their newspaper industry. So they've needed our newspapers more than ever, and as they've found that they can't get them, they've actually started recycling more and more their newspapers. So you have a burgeoning and very large newspaper recycling industry in China right now.
Adam, I know that there is a limit to how much you can, I mean, how many times you can sort of send paper back to be recycled. The quality degrades over time.
Sure.
Is that the case with things like metal and plastic as well?
It sure is. I mean, newspapers and paper in general, it depends on the kind of paper you're talking about, but you can really only run it through the recycling process 6 to 8 times. With plastics, most plastics can only be recycled once. And when they are recycled, they're actually downgraded. So they're turned into something like a plastic lumber that you might use on your deck. It's just very, very expensive to recycle most plastics. And the economic incentive isn't there to use all the energy that would be needed to maintain them in their current form. So only a few plastics are actually recycled into a prior use. Automobile taillights, believe it or not, are one of them. That's a very expensive plastic. As for metals, it's a more complicated story. I mean, nothing is 100% recyclable. That is, you put something in and you don't get 100% of it out. So even metals, which are melted down, and the metal recycling industry likes to talk about metals as, endlessly renewable. Every time an aluminum can is melted, a little bit of that can is lost in the process, vaporized, drips on the floor, whatever it may be. So that's one loss. The other loss is that, we have alloys, metals that are mixed together. Brass is an alloy. And once something is brass, for example, it's very hard to turn it back into its constituent metals. It's very expensive. So you also lose stuff along that way. So one of the messages of the book is, really don't think of your recycling as sort of a way to almost put that, that brass back into the ground, that aluminum can back into the ground and replace it, or put that tree back in the forest. It's really not. It's just a way to sort of string out your resource, your raw material demands for a little while longer. But ultimately, if you're recycling on the basis of being an environmentalist, the best thing you can do is reduce and reuse.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because we always hear reduce, reuse, recycle, and there is, in fact, a hierarchy of how good they are for the environment, sort of in the exact opposite order.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, and that's one of the messages I've been, trying to sort of impress upon people. I mean, recycling is great. It's what you do to hold off the trash man a little while longer, but you're still using materials. I mean, if you really want to come at recycling and your stuff from an environmental standpoint, the best thing you can do is not buy it at all. Then you're not going to, by buying that newspaper, you're still going to put stress on our paper needs, on our metal needs. So, you know, no matter if you're recycling it or not, so not to buy it at all is the first step. Well, most people, including me, aren't going to be very content with doing that. We all want to consume. I want an iPhone upgrade just as much as the next person. So the next step, and I think the one that we can all embrace on some level, is to reuse, and not just reuse, but buy better products. You know, a friend of mine said something to me the other day that I hadn't thought of, but he said, you know, buy cheap, buy twice. And you know, and that's something that we've done in the United States in particular. Is, you know, we have a lot of cheap products, but we cycle through them very quickly. If we buy better products, things that last longer, or even more importantly, things that we can upgrade. You know, if you can switch out the battery in your phone, and you can't do that with an iPhone, or upgrade it, you're going to keep that product longer, and you're going to put less stress on raw material supplies. Only after you've sort of, you know, been unable to do those two should we really be recycling. And recycling, as I said, it you know, it's great. It lengthens out the amount of time that we're, you know, in demand on raw materials, but ultimately you're consuming.
And some of the things that we sort of trash in this country do not instantly get stripped down for their component parts. Things like phones can be pretty successfully refurbished and then sold in markets in the developing world.
Absolutely, and this has been something that's starting to, you know, sort of come up on the horizon of many consumers here, is the idea that even if you don't want your mobile phone, somebody else might. And, you know, over the years, we've had a number of documentaries and newspaper articles that have documented these so-called e-waste dumping grounds in places like South China. They've kind of been misunderstood because the purpose of these areas certainly was recycling, and no doubt I've been in these places, and the environmental conditions can be very bad. But the primary purpose of these places was to bring in Western developed country electronics and repair them and refurbish them for sale in the developed world. And so if you go to a place like Guiyu, which was featured in 60 Minutes a few years ago, if you can look at the recycling areas, but if you actually go into the workshops, what you'll see going on there are people extracting chips from old phones and putting them into new ones, or putting them together in an inventory so they can be sold to manufacturers in South China so that they can be reused. This is controversial. The consumer electronics companies like Samsung and Apple aren't particularly fond of this trade for obvious reasons, because it's going to cut into demand for their new products. And so you see Apple in particular trying to get into the market for used phones, in part because they can then compete against this. But it's a very real market, and it's a real option for people, especially in the developing world, to get their hands on technologies that they wouldn't be able to afford otherwise. So I see it as a very positive development, and one that, you know, I hope American consumers start paying more attention to as an option for getting rid of their old electronics.
And some of the things that you're describing, Adam, sound like highly skilled labor, which might take people by surprise.
Absolutely. I mean, we definitely have this stereotype in the U.S. and the EU and even Japan of scrap workers in the developing world being enslaved and exploited. But one of the things that's been really enjoyable for me, really remarkable, is finding out just how skilled they are. You know, you don't take apart an iPhone and extract the reusable components of it without having some technical level. And what I found in the 11 years I've been covering this is not only are they skilled, but they're being paid for that. So when I started covering this industry in 2002 in China, if you went to South China or Central China, the average wage for one of these workers was around $80 to $100 a month, plus room and board. These days, it can trend as high as $800 to $900. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There's increasing labor shortages there, but there's also recognition within China that this is highly skilled work, and that the best employees, the best workers capable of doing this, are actually worth the money. They will make employers real money.
Adam Minter is my guest. He's Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview and author of the new book, Junkyard Planet: Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. You can join the conversation now by emailing think@kera.org, sending a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think, or calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Adam Minter. He's a contributor to The Atlantic and Foreign Policy magazines and Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview. His new book is called Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Adam, recycling sounds to us very postmodern and sort of environmentally conscious, but people have been doing this sort of work out of necessity for hundreds of years.
Absolutely. I mean, it's you know, it certainly predates the Industrial Revolution. People have been, you know, taking their old swords and you know, beating them into plowshares. That isn't recycling. I don't know what is. But during the Industrial Revolution in particular, there started to be such real demand for metals and other materials, and there started to be a raw material supply chain, that that's when it really started. And I think one of the things that surprised me most in writing the book and researching it, and I think it surprised a lot of my readers, is just how early this globalization of the industry started. In the 1850s, the United States was a major scrap importer from England. It imported two things, rags, believe it or not, for the making of paper, and then it started importing steel from the UK to help it build railroads. And there were some really good reasons for that. Certainly the U.S. had the raw materials to make steel on its own, but opening up, you know, steel mines, iron ore mines, is very expensive and very slow. And so the fastest way to get this kind of material was to import it from the UK, which was generating more than it could use. And so you already had the globalization of this industry actually in the 19th century. And then in the 19-teens, the U.S. actually became a net scrap exporter when it started generating more recycling than it could use on its own. And that was even before there was such a word as recycling. You know, the word recycling didn't come around until the 1920s, and it at the time actually applied just to recirculating oil through a refinery. That was recycling of a kind, but recycling as we think of it really didn't come on to the sort of the general public's radar until the 1960s.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Maggie on the line in Fort Worth. Hey, Maggie.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, you've mentioned the recent iCall, but I would like you to expand on the whole process of rags. In the turn of the last century, rag picking was one of those activities that was spurned and all that, but it was very necessary. Today, when I drive down the street and I see piles of trash at the curb, and might be curtains or furniture or things that have fiber as the covers, and maybe batting in the filling, and then when you think about all the clothes we discard, how much of that makes it into paper or other products? Are we very good at recycling our fiber at this point?
Thanks for your call.
That's a marvelous question. The rag trade is something that's almost unknown in this day, but she's quite right. The rag trade was really almost the beginnings of the North American scrap trade. And as it happens, my great-grandfather, that's how he got his start in recycling, and he got his start in Galveston, Texas. And what he would do is he would literally go down the street. If there were rags on the ground, and there weren't many because people would hold on to them, but he would go door to door and essentially buy rags, use dirty rags used for cleaning, and he'd buy them and then take them to rag recycling operations where they'd be sorted into colors and then sold to paper mills for making into paper. If some of them weren't soiled too badly, they'd be washed and reused in companies that did that. And that was a gigantic trade, and it was the major recycling industry in the U.S. right up until about the 1920s. It hasn't gone away. There is a rag recycling trade, but it's much more consolidated now, and you actually have companies that buy and sell industrial-use rags, towels from hotels, and it's only a very small number of companies, but that sort of thing is either reused or, if it can't be reused, it actually goes into fiber. In terms of the used clothing trade, there isn't really a clothing recycling trade in the United States anymore. So much of that clothing actually goes overseas where it's reused, and much of it then eventually makes its way into paper mills. In terms of the percentages that are recovered, you know, in the U.S. of our used clothing and curtains, so far as I know, there are no stats on that, and I always tell people this. I mean, statistics on waste and recycling are very, very hard to actually calculate And so it's, you know, I have at the beginning of my book actually a disclaimer telling people there's stats in this book, but you should only, you know, sort of believe them. So it's very hard to say, especially in terms of the used clothing trade.
Well, clothing fibers, like much like things like plastic, have to be cleaned before they can be used. And this can be an issue in many parts of the developing world today where, say, a bunch of plastic bottles come in, but they have to be soaked in this caustic material before they can be melted back down into pellets.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very big problem. And I describe this in the book, a town in northern China called Wenan, which was, until quite recently, possibly one of the two or three largest plastics recycling zones on the planet. And the way that they would recycle a lot of plastics is it'd be by hand. So you would bring in these plastics. About half of the plastics came from the Beijing area, which is a gigantic megalopolis, and about half would be imported from around the world. And the workers would take these plastics, wash them in these bleaches, these semi-caustic bleaches, by hand so that they could then be melted down cleanly and made into new plastics or downgraded into the plastic lumber. You know, anywhere that you have plastics recycling, certainly you're going to be cleaning that stuff. But when you do it in the home-style workshops where this kind of work was and still is done in places like China and India, there really isn't, very rarely will there be water treatment options for these kinds of bleaches and detergents. And so what happens to them? People do the easiest thing. They, you know, they dump them on the ground when they're done, or even better, you know, you dump them in the nearest creek or river. So it can be a very environmentally destructive process, absolutely.
What about recycling in the United States? I think many people are familiar with the curbside pickup, which now doesn't really even require us to separate things out, right? They'll say, throw in your glass and your plastic and your paper and we'll deal with it. How do they deal with it when it gets to a centralized facility, and how much is automated and how much is done by human beings?
Sure. It's a great question. One thing you know, a lot of folks maybe don't realize at this point is the U.S. is still recycling about 60% of the materials that get tossed into the proverbial blue bin. An increasing amount is recycled in the way that you described. It's called single source recycling, and what it is, you mix up all your recycling, and it goes to a centralized depot where there is mechanical means of actually sorting out the various components in there. So you can actually mechanically sort newspaper from cardboard, from glass bottles, from laundry detergent containers, to whatever else you may put in there. And these are incredibly sophisticated lines. I actually describe in the first chapter of the book the line that Waste Management has installed in Houston just in the last couple of years, and it's an extraordinary technological achievement. Nonetheless, for all of the technology that goes into one of these, they still require human beings to be standing over some of the conveyors to pick out some of the trash that goes in there. And certain kinds of plastics, for example, there simply isn't an affordable way to identify them, much must eliminate them from the recycling line, except to use humans.
And do plastics have to have that little triangular symbol on the back to be viable for recycling?
Well, I mean, theoretically, any kind of plastic can be recycled, you know, and I describe in the book, you know, the recycling of insulation from Christmas tree lights.
Yeah.
Obviously, that doesn't require and doesn't have the triangular symbol. That triangular symbol is kind of interesting. Now that we have sort of this single source recycling, you know, everything goes into one barrel, and obviously the infrared detectors aren't looking for that triangle. They're using other means to identify the stuff. But if you're in a place that doesn't allow you to put all of your recycling into a bin, some places in the United States will require you to sort those out via the various numbers in that triangle. Some are called sixes, some are called sevens. And so that can be helpful, but anything plastic theoretically can be recycled. The question is whether it can be recycled in the United States or overseas, and whether it can be recycled, frankly, in a manner that's safe. And those are all, you know, open questions. You know, we like to think of recycling as, again, as this good deed. It's this very black and white, or I guess you could say green and white thing. But if you spend time around the industry, it's very gray. It's sometimes morally ambiguous. You don't know whether really what you're doing is good or bad for the environment, and that makes it a very complicated thing to judge correctly.
So talk about these Christmas lights, because it seems like every year when our family gets ready to decorate for the holidays, there's one strand that no longer works or has, you know, like one light that will light up. And to be honest, we have thrown those in the trash. But in fact, there is an entire town that has made a name for itself by stripping out the usable components from these in China.
Yeah, what you know, it took me a long time to find this. A few years ago, I was in a scrapyard in China, and I saw a pile of Christmas lights that probably weighed a couple tons, believe it or not. And over the course of a couple of years, I was able to find my way to a place called Shijiao, which is a town in southern China, where they have been recycling Christmas tree lights for years. And by the estimate of the factory owner who I visited there, probably somewhere in the range of 20 million pounds of American Christmas tree lights per year are recycled there. Now, there's sort of two questions related to this. How do they get there, and how are they recycled?
Right.
How they get there is complicated. I mean, you know, we all know that there are Christmas tree light drop-offs, that you can take them to the Salvation Army, you can take them to your local scrapyard, and that's one way that this stuff is accumulated and makes its way to scrapyards where it's sold, you know, by the ton to China. And they sell it to China because it's not a very good quality wire to recycle. Let me explain that. In the U.S., we have a lot of wire that we generate from things like telephone cables hanging over, you know, our heads and that kind of thing. That sort of cable is about 90% copper, maybe 80% copper. And copper is worth about 3 1/4 a pound right now. A Christmas tree light strand is worth about 28% copper. So if you have a choice between recycling something that's 90% copper or 28%, you're going to keep the 90% stuff. And that's what stays in the U.S. And something like a Christmas tree light will go overseas where there's just more copper demand. China's copper industry outstrips the U.S. copper industry by about 5 times. So they want that stuff. It's raw material for them. So the way the stuff gets recycled is it's basically floated. And the way this works is you basically chop up the Christmas tree lights in what looks like a wood chipper, mix it with water, and then you basically allow the copper to float to the bottom of the water, and the insulation floats to the top. And it's a little more complicated than that, and there's some different components to the process. But it's about, you get, you know, on the first pass, about a 95% separation, which is amazing. And it's pollution-free, which is also great.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with John in Dallas. Hey, John.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, wondering if you had in this book anything about the printer cartridge reuse or recycling business, because I'm kind of aware of it and know that it's a pretty big business, and that the brand name printer companies are actively trying to block it by various tricks they do that make it very difficult to reuse the various ink cartridges. And just curious if he had anything in his book about that.
Thanks for your call.
I don't have anything in the book about it, but you are correct. There is a very large printer cartridge, laser jet cartridge, reuse industry that actually boomed in South China during the last decade. And the Chinese government, especially the provincial government, actually made a pretty concerted effort to shut it down. And the rumor is, and I've never been involved in this directly, with the encouragement of the printer cartridge manufacturers who didn't want this business going on because it hurt their business, to shut it down. But there isn't anything in the book in that, and I haven't written about it in the past.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Adam, can you tell us a little bit more about, you essentially grew up in and around your family's junkyard in Minneapolis. What was that like? And I guess the matriarch there was your grandmother. Talk about her role in the business.
Sure, sure. I come from, you know, I sometimes say I was born in the junkyard. my great-grandfather came to the U.S. from Russia in the early part of the 20th century, and he actually came through Galveston, where he scrapped rags and eventually made his way up to Minneapolis, where he formed a business. And that's a very common story. It's a, you know, the scrap business is usually a business for outsiders who, you know, don't have language skills in the country they're in and may face some discrimination. And they do what they can. I call it the entrepreneurial opportunity of last resort. You pick up rags, you pick up what other people don't want, and figure out a way to make money from it. My grandmother grew up, you know, in a household where that was the ethic, and I started spending time with her at the family junkyard at a very young age. And if we weren't at the junkyard, we were going to garage sales and, you know, basically going through the same process, you know, going through the garage sale, looking for stuff that other people don't want, trying to find that bargain. That's kind of what you do in a junkyard, too. People will bring you stuff, and you're always looking for, you know, the value in what other people bring in, and you offer them a price such that you can maybe make a little bit of money yourself. You know, family businesses, whether junkyards or, you know, a convenience store, are always complicated places. They're colorful places, and the scrap business was a colorful place to grow up. I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time sitting at watching the scale numbers with my grandmother and watching our cameras to see, you know, if the employees were taking home some of the treasures for themselves. So those are actually, you know, very funny and very positive memories for me. That may sound strange, you know, thinking the having positive memories of watching your employees steal, but that's kind of all part of the sort of the small family scrap business story, and it's shaped sort of my ethic in going out into the world. And even as a journalist, I mean, good journalism is finding that little tidbit, you know, and what other people are overlooking.
And hanging on like a junkyard dog when
exactly.
a source refuses to talk, right?
Yeah.
We have a tweet here from Matthew who I think is looking for a clarification. I'll try and paraphrase, but he says,
sure.
You mentioned that iPhone batteries can't be replaced, but that China refurbishes them for parts. However, you can get a new iPhone battery on Amazon for $15. Can you clarify?
Sure, yeah, that's a great point. No, I should clarify. I mean, it's not an easy thing to replace your own iPhone battery. As we all know, there are smartphones where you can actually open up the back and just switch out the battery. The iPhone requires that you actually, if you want to maintain your warranty at least, you actually need to take your iPhone in for service by Apple, and it costs, I believe, $90, if somebody could check that, and you need to give it up for 3 to 5 days. But it is possible. There's lots of DIY stuff on the internet and kits that help you actually change it out yourself. The overall point with that was, though, that most people aren't going to do that DIY. And the product like the Apple iPhone, and I don't mean to pick on Apple, actually makes it harder for people to sort of extend the length of the lives of their own electronics. And most people aren't going to switch out that battery. So I'm glad he asked that. That's a great question. And yes, there are DIY kits out there that allow you to do it yourself.
Adam Minter is with us. His new book is called Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. You can join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. Send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think or send email to think@kera.org. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview, Adam Minter. His new book is called Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Adam, a lot of people in this country sort of look at China and the environmental problems it has and assume that people there simply don't care about the environment. That turns out not to be the case. There are many Chinese who are quite worried about the impact of these kinds of businesses on the places they live.
Absolutely. You know, and just in the last year, there's been a really intensive effort called Green Fence by the Chinese government to actually regulate some of the imports of foreign scrap materials, not just metal and paper, but especially plastics. And they're making more of a concerted effort to regulate and upgrade the recycling that's done for China. So you've actually seen environmental protests in China targeting, for example, the lead recycling industry and lead-acid battery recycling. We have to remember that China is now the world's largest automobile buyer, and everything that goes with that, including the recycling, is potentially a problem. And the biggest problem related to automobile recycling is automobile battery recycling. Mm. You know, we've known that. We had that problem in the United States, and they have it there now. And these protests have actually had a positive impact on how China's recycling. I mean, now they have, just in the last year, a battery recycling system that isn't perfect. It isn't up to our U.S. standards by any stretch, but the pressure has created one that's better than what they had And so it's improving generally. At the same time, there is a growing recognition that China achieves environmental benefits by importing, you know, American and Japanese and European scrap. As we all know, you know, recycling requires less energy, and it generates less pollution than, say, mining iron ore, you know, out in Tibet, or cutting down a forest up in northern China's Heilongjiang Forest. So there's also recognition that there's real benefits to doing this, and you see that on a grassroots level, but you also see it, and this is probably the most stunning and important development, you see it on a very, very high government level. China still plans its economy in these what are called five-year plans, and it sounds very Maoist, and I think it is, but within these five-year plans, over the last two five-year plans, they've actually emphasized the need for what's called a circular economy. And that circular economy essentially is a recycling economy and the use of renewable materials. So you actually see, despite all the pollution that can be associated with this industry in China, you see a general level of improvement. And more than that, you see a recognition that this is the proper way to go as they develop further. It's remarkable.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have David on the line in California. Hi, David.
Hey, greetings. You know, I wanted to ask you about the pricing of recycled batteries. Out here in San Francisco, you know, we have so many tourists that batteries are all over the street, especially the small ones that fit in, Walkman kind of appliances. And as I understand it, the guys that walk around with shopping carts don't even mess with batteries. If they're honest, they don't mess with batteries because they can't get a real price for them. But the dishonest guys are slipping them into aluminum cans just so they can raise the amount of weight that comes in with their aluminum cans. But when they do that, they're basically poisoning that aluminum. So if they make new aluminum cans, they're going to have either mercury or lead or whatever's in these batteries mixed in with the aluminum, and that basically poisons people that are drinking Coke. And so I'm wondering if there's a way that, you know, market forces or something can actually create an honest price for these batteries so that we don't poison ourselves in the long run.
Thanks so much for your call, David.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Now, I can't tell you what the market prices are right now, but it sort of gets at a wider point that I make in the book, is that, you know, if there isn't an economic incentive to do this, to do some kind of recycling, it's not going to happen. And perversely, it seems like the economic incentive to recycle batteries out in the San Francisco Bay Area is, to weigh down your aluminum cans so they weigh heavier when you take them to the recycling center. This is a really big problem, and it's one that's being faced not just by the United States, but also in China, because those small batteries are expensive to recycle. And so what's happened in China, believe it or not, is they made the decision that the proper way to handle this potentially hazardous material is to make it not hazardous. And so what we just had in the last year in China is the Chinese government saying, it's okay, you can now throw your batteries into the trash because we've basically regulated out all of the mercury. So they're not going to be a problem in the landfill. That's amazing, and it's a very pragmatic approach to this. And I think, at least for China, it was probably the right one. With all the environmental issues they have and all the recycling issues they have, batteries as an overall share of the waste stream probably aren't very big. You know, within the United States, I don't think people are going to tolerate that kind of thing, but it gets at a wider point, which is then if we want to recycle these things, we're going to have to pay for them. And one way or another, that's we're going to have to create economic incentives, and so maybe subsidizing the recycling of that material will be the way, because unless there's an economic incentive for recycling these materials, which are very expensive to recycle, it's just not going to happen.
Is it fair to say that those economic incentives are why we have so many municipal recycling programs now that we didn't in the past, that cities have found ways to turn these into at least a minor revenue source?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's funny. I tell the story in the book. In 2008, when the global economy crashed in the fall of 2008, it absolutely devastated a lot of these municipal recycling programs because they had become accustomed over the last prior 15 years to, you know, ever-increasing prices for recycling. Paper and metals in particular had gone up a lot. And the reason they'd gone up a lot is because China had come on the international markets and started buying up all this stuff because they needed it to power their economy. Well, in 2008, when Lehman crashed and consumer demand for new products crashed, so did the demand for recycling. And so you had in recycling warehouses, municipal recycling warehouses across the United States and the EU, which once made a lot of money off their cardboard, for example, not being able to sell it anymore. And I remember doing in 2008 a Radio Call-In show in Ireland where I actually, you know, was having Irish callers call in and complain to me about the fact that the municipal recycling warehouses were landfilling and incinerating all that cardboard that they'd recycled and bundled up so carefully. But China wasn't in the market for it anymore because they didn't need to make new cardboard boxes to put, you know, Nike shoes into. So once the recycling markets recovered, they were able to actually, you know, sell that cardboard again. But without the economic incentive to do it, without demand from China in particular, which drives up demand, the price of recyclables in the United States, it's just not an economically viable thing to do.
Let's jump back to the phones now. We have Timmy on the line in Oak Cliff. Hey, Timmy.
Hi. Hey, so my question for you is, how does, here in the United States, and obviously from what I've heard in the EU, we've got a pretty good habit of having blue bins and having recycling centers in towns, but how does it look globally, not just here? You know, China's got a great industry of making use of the recycled material, but do they do it at a residential level at all? And how does it look around the rest of the world?
Sure, that's a tremendous question. There's no blue bin in my apartment in Shanghai, and I've never encountered a blue bin in any apartment anywhere in China, India, or any of the other developing countries where I've actually reported on recycling. And yet, these countries have much higher recycling rates than we do in the United States. And the reason is pretty simple, and that is that wages are still pretty low in those countries, and employment opportunities can still be scarce. And so there's an economic incentive for somebody to go through basically the trash bins of China and India and pull the recycling out. You know, we're all familiar with films like Slumdog Millionaire. I think many of us have seen pictures of, you know, Philippine dumps where you have children, you know, going through those dumps pulling recycling out. The Philippines is a pretty extreme example, but it holds generally that in developing countries, you have the opportunity, as an entrepreneur, or somebody who doesn't have much way of making a living, to actually pull this stuff out. And so if you go to a Chinese dump, for example, it looks very different from a U.S. dump. A U.S. Dump landfill is filled with recyclable waste. You'll see cardboard and cans and bottles, and it's just heartbreaking. If you go to a Chinese dump, it's largely food waste. You know, it's a lot of rotten watermelon and other food waste, and it's because all the recycling's been pulled out.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and we'll speak with Jason in Dallas. Hey, Jason.
Hey, how's it going? I got a question. I'm a general construction superintendent, and whenever we are renovating houses or anything of the like, we end up with these giant bundles of aluminum, copper, and various other metals in there with their insulation still on them. And, you know, the architects don't want them anymore. They say take them and do something with them. Is there some sort of way to go about melting that stuff down and removing the insulation and just ending up with like a block of different metals all in one, and then just selling that block and then having whoever I sell it to break it down?
That's a really interesting question. Thanks, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not real good on sort of the technical questions of recycling, but I will tell you that, you know, melting down, you know, say insulated copper or insulated aluminum at home or even in a workplace, you know, can be a dirty, polluting thing. And I don't recommend it. You're going to need all kinds of permits to do it. You know, scrap recycling businesses go through a lot of trouble to get those permits. You know, your best bet really is just to sell it with the insulation on it. You won't run into any environmental problems. And the scrap companies will, you know, whether they are in the United States or whether they're overseas in India or China, they'll do that, and the good thing is they'll not only melt, or well, they won't melt off the insulation, but they'll not only melt down the metal, but one of the great things about developing world recycling is they'll actually recover the insulation and recycle that too. It's amazing, you know, wire recyclers in the United States, they actually, once they've removed the insulation, because they don't burn it off, they actually landfill it or incinerate it, and they'll do it in licensed incinerators. But in the developing world, and especially in China, the market for that insulation is real. And so they will not only remove the insulation, they'll actually sell it to people who will make it into new products. So I'd recommend just, you know, bundling that stuff up, insulation and all, and taking it down to your local scrapyard and getting the best price you can for it.
So it turns out that recycling a car is a complicated thing with multiple stages, but we've actually become quite sophisticated at gleaning every reusable material possible from the autos that get junked in this country.
Absolutely. It's an extraordinary business, and it's an extraordinary process. And most of us don't realize that, you know, in the 1950s and early 1960s, right up to about 1970, in fact, the abandonment of automobiles was one of the most serious environmental problems in the United States. There's some estimates that there were as many as 40 million automobiles abandoned across the American countryside, and President Johnson and Lady Bird Johnson actually made these abandoned automobiles a big part of their Beautify America campaign. The way that cars are recycled in the United States was actually invented down there in Texas in the San Antonio and Houston areas. They're essentially shredded into small parts, and then you use magnets and other technologies to separate out the various metals. Sometimes those shredded metals, instead of being separated in the United States, they're actually sent to China and India for hand sorting because as good as the technology is, almost always a hand sorter, a well-trained hand sorter, and it's skilled work, can do it better than we can. One of the more extraordinary things I came across while I was in the midst of researching my book was actually a company up in Detroit, Michigan called Huron Valley Steel Company, where they do the mechanical separation, and they've actually developed a means to recover all the change that sort of falls out of our pockets between the seats in a car. And they told me while I was up there that the average American automobile is actually recycled and shredded with, on average, about $1.65 in change stuck between the seats. Well, you know, there's anywhere from 11 to 14 million automobiles shredded in the United States every year. So that adds up to real money, and they showed me the process they developed to extract that. And I stood beneath a conveyor that was doing things that I can't tell you about. They don't want the trade secret revealed, and literally watched it raining money. And to me, that's one of the greatest businesses I've ever seen, you know, making money from money. It's just amazing.
It's good to know, yeah, that all those quarters I've dropped getting drive-through coffee or whatever, someday maybe someone will get them back.
Yeah, it really happens.
Is there anything, we just have a few seconds left, but is your consumption pretty much the same as it's always been because that you grew up in this rather thrifty environment, or has your behavior changed since doing this work?
You know, if my behavior changed in China and starting to see just how much Chinese consumers are buying, and it sort of hit me while living there that, you know, we're just not going to be able, as a planet, I'm not talking as a country or as China and the U.S., sustain this level of consumption at an affordable level, if we continue consuming, all the stuff that we are. So that sort of impacted my the way that I consume, and I do generally make an effort now, since moving to China 11 years ago, to buy better stuff, to reuse more, and to hopefully stretch out a little bit my demand on raw materials.
Adam Minter's new book is called Junkyard Planet: Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. Adam, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.